Today is Columbus Day, but did you also know that Illinois has a new holiday, Indigenous Peoples Day?
It's about changing the narrative about who we are as Native American people across the United States. We are a very misunderstood group. It is time to really help change the narrative of who we are.
That's Native News Online's Levi Rickert. Heather Miller from the American Indian Center of Chicago also joins us. And are you looking forward to being able to do this? We've got some suggestions for trips to check out the fall leaves this season all across Illinois. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay with us. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up today, it may not seem like we're ready for it, but we want to get you prepared for some trips to see fall leaves. We'll help you plan for that. But first, today is Columbus Day. It's been a federal holiday since 1934, and it's been observed locally and by Italian Americans for many years before that. But in recent decades, state, communities, and tribal governments have pushed back because of Christopher Columbus's role in enslaving and killing the native people of what are now called the West Indies. Today, many states still officially observe Columbus Day, but it's actually not the same everywhere. And four states, Oregon, Alaska, Hawaii, and South Dakota, don't observe Columbus Day at all. Some cities have replaced it with Indigenous Peoples Day. Here in Illinois, we actually have both. Last year, the state legislature passed a law that designated Indigenous Peoples Day as the last Monday of September, and they kept Columbus Day on the second Monday of October, today. If you didn't know about that law when it passed, well, you're not alone, because the American Indian Center of Chicago was also surprised to learn about this. Joining me now is Heather Miller, the center's executive director. Levi Rickert is also on the line with us from Grand Rapids, Michigan, where he's editor of Native News Online. Heather, Levi, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's our pleasure.
Levi, can I start by asking you, I mentioned that Columbus Day has been a federal holiday since the 1930s. I wonder if you can tell us how long there's been an organized pushback to that commemoration. And I'm thinking especially when we're talking about tribal governments and peoples.
Well, I think it goes back to like 1992, and that was the quincentennial 500th anniversary of Columbus arriving in the Western Hemisphere. Since then, there's been, I think, like 20-some cities that have changed, and it just seems to be gaining popularity. So I'm really happy with the progress that's being made.
Heather, what about the Chicago area, or even thinking about Illinois, how long has there been resistance to Columbus Day in this state?
I would echo Levi's comments, actually. I think we started to gain a lot of momentum around 1992. Folks were starting to really rethink the presence of Columbus and rethink that story. And folks started to gain some more awareness around Indigenous peoples here in the city of Chicago. They started to really question that history and make sure that we were recognizing the true history of Native folks here on our land.
And when we're talking about that true history, I wonder what it's like, Heather, to be talking about this holiday around this time. You all do many events during the year, and certainly there's a lot of important issues besides Columbus Day that could be talked about more. What does this holiday feel like for you?
Personally, for me, I have always been a little disappointed to celebrate Columbus Day, just because it really does ignore a really disturbing piece of our history and a piece of our past, and it fails to acknowledge the fact that Native folks have always been a part of this land. We were the original inhabitants of this land, and so not recognizing that fact and glossing over the history of Native contributions to this country, to me, is just really disappointing. disappointing fact. And so I'd prefer to see a holiday where we do acknowledge Indigenous people and celebrate the impacts that they've had on our history and especially on the government system here in the United States.
And I do want to talk about that in particular, but I do want to ask you about the Indigenous Peoples Day that happens here in Illinois. So now we have Indigenous Peoples Day and Columbus Day. Did you know that the legislature was considering this bill last year to create an Indigenous Peoples Day?
We did not. This was quite a shock to us. We found out after it had already been signed into law. In fact, I think we found out in October, and we didn't even find out in September that this happened. And so not allowing us to be at the table or to have our voices heard, again, emphasized this fact that all too often here in the state of Illinois, we Native American folks are seen or we're not seen. We're an invisible people. And so not allowing us to have a voice on this particular law really reiterated that fact. And it was a slap in the face to us.
And I wonder since this, if you've been able to voice that to lawmakers, to the governor, has that message been heard?
We always try to make sure that we're speaking that message. We do talk to the governor. We do talk to other elected officials. We've got strong backing locally from our aldermen, and we've got a lot of support from folks at CPS, Chicago Public Schools, that also would like to see some change on that issue. So we're making some positive change on more of a local level, and folks are hearing us in that space, but we're still seeing some big disconnect up in higher positions, such as the governor position.
Levi, I wonder if this story that Heather's sharing, if you see this as unusual, if there are other examples of this disconnect across the country?
Well, I think very much so. And I think that's what I think is important, that we do recognize the Indigenous Peoples Day. It gives that invisible population that Heather referred to, and we don't necessarily consider ourselves that way. However, we do, in a sense, have to argue our very existence on an ongoing basis because our population base is so small, less than 2% of the general population in the United States. But Indigenous Peoples Day allows for local communities of American Indians and tribal people, maybe down from Canada, the First Nations people, to really, really highlight who we are as Indigenous people. And, you know, we have really rich cultures, rich histories, sometimes sad histories. However, there's been a major resurgence in recent decades of who we are as Native people. And I always like to tell people it's time to celebrate who we are and have a voice.
And Heather, when we're thinking about celebrating who we are in Illinois, I wonder if I can ask you to give us a better picture of that. Levi, I know you're based in Michigan. I wonder if you could follow up with more of a Michigan or Midwestern picture. But Heather, can we start with Illinois?
Absolutely. So Illinois is an interesting state in that we don't have any federally recognized tribes that reside here in the state. But we have the third largest urban Indian population in the country. So we have a really thriving Indigenous community here locally, and we are doing many things to keep our culture alive and to keep our histories on the forefront of people's minds. The word Chicago is a Native word reflective of the communities that called this land their original homelands. And so every single day when I get up in the morning, I'm reminded that I'm living here on Indigenous land in Indigenous territory. And so it's really important to me just to continue to celebrate the fact that we have a really thriving Native community here in Illinois.
And Heather, in fact, the word Chicago, as you mentioned, that's a Native term. Is it for an onion, or it's kind of like an onion? Is that where Chicago comes from?
Yeah, there are a couple of different interpretations because there were quite a few tribes that originally called this area home. And so one of the translations is wild onion or ramp, like we have those ramps here in our marshy swamps. But then another tribe here in the area, it would have translated into skunk, basically a kind of pungent smell of Chicago.
And Illinois is also a native, the Illini were also a Native American tribe, but that wasn't the only tribal group in Illinois, right?
So typically when we acknowledge the territory of the original people here in Chicago, we recognize the Council of the Three Fires tribes, the Potawatomi, the Ojibwe, and the Odawa.
And when we look at the history of the state, there was an Illinois Confederation, right? Was it more than a dozen tribes that were in this part of the country originally?
There would have been, yes, there definitely would have been more than just the Council of the Three Fires. There would have been tribes from all across the country that would have spent time here in this area and would have done trading and interacted with one another.
And Levi, when we talk about the whole idea that you want to be telling the stories of people now, you do that through your news site. I should mention Native News Online. We'll tweet out a link to that. But what other important stories do you think people are missing now?
Well, I think that the recent resistance in the Dakota Access Pipeline that took place over a series of several months back in 2016, 2017, at Standing Rock really highlighted who we are as Indigenous people and the very concerns that we have for the environment. And the mantra became many Wiconi, meaning water is life, and water is so important to human existence. And the idea that if there's a burst of the pipeline in the Missouri River, 18 million people downriver would be impacted. So it's very significant what Native people, in terms of their influence on the environment, it's been said we were the first environmentalists. And that's one of the things I, as a Native person, I'm really proud of. I mean, I was at Sandy Rock to see the 10,000 people that I saw out there, tribes from all over the United States, dealt with people from the European press, people from Japan, from the press, people there to really highlight who we were as Native people and how we were united. It made me feel very proud to be an American Indian.
And Heather, I wonder, as we think about that, I feel like for many people, the Standing Rock has faded from their memory as it's faded from the headlines. Are there other stories that you also think are important to keep for people to keep foremost in their minds now?
I think Standing Rock is an absolutely critical piece to keep in one's mind.
To still keep it.
Contemporary issues. But we also have other tribes here around the area that are also battling very similar environmental issues. So just right in our backyard, the Menominee in Wisconsin are fighting against a mine that would be located on their traditional homeland, some of their traditional territory, that would create basically a Superfund site. And they are working really hard to make sure that that does not happen. So you can find their information on the No Back 40 Mine Facebook page, and it tells you more about their fight and more about their struggle in terms of helping to protect their land and their water as well.
And those protests are going on right now, Heather?
Correct.
So, Heather, just to sum up, do you think that in your mind, should an Indigenous Peoples Day replace Columbus Day on the second Monday of October?
This is not meant, or the removal of Columbus Day is not meant as a disrespect to Italian Americans. And one thing that I think would be more appropriate as we move forward with name changes and rethinking some of these holidays, I would prefer to see that we actually have an Italian American Heritage Day, where we really celebrate the highlight or the contributions that Italian Americans have made to this country and focus on more of the positive aspects of their culture and their presence as American citizens. It to me, just seems that focusing on someone that contributed to genocide and to really harmful history of our Native people is not the way to go. And so I'd rather see us have a holiday designated to the really positive contributions from Italian American communities.
As I said before, Indigenous Peoples Days really allows for us to talk about who we are. This summer, there was a study released, I think it's called Reclaiming Truth, and it's about changing the narrative about who we are as Native American people across the United States. We are a very misunderstood group. We are invisible, as Heather alluded to earlier. It is time to really help change the narrative of who we are, because chances are, kids are going to school with your kids, our kids are going to school with your kids, and I think it's time for coexistence, and it's very important that we all learn to get along and respect each other's cultures. That's so important to celebrate who we are as Native people, and other cultures like the Italian Americans celebrate who they are, as they have made tremendous contributions to this country.
Thanks for sharing that. Heather Miller, she's Executive Director of the American Indian Center of Chicago. I want to thank Levi Rickert for being with us as well on the line from Michigan, where he's editor of Native News Online. Both of you, thanks for taking the time to speak with me. I appreciate it.
It's been my
pleasure.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much.
Support comes from the Center for Advanced Study, presenting a talk by Professor James Anderson, Citizenship, Immigration, and National Identity, Civic Education on the Sesquicentennial Anniversary of the 14th Amendment, Wednesday, October 17th at 7:30 p.m. at Spurlock Museum. More at cas.illinois.edu.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Brian Moline. Later in the show, Nyla will talk to Nuno Ribeiro about some places you can visit this season to see fall leaves. But before that, we wanted to turn to a story out of Chicago. It's been one of the biggest stories in the city the past few years. On October 20th, 2014, Chicago police officer Jason Van Dyke shot and killed 17-year-old Laquan McDonald. Evidence later showed that McDonald was shot 16 times in about 15 seconds. It was more than a year before the public got to see the dash cam video of that shooting, and that video had enormous consequences. Protesters galvanized over a possible cover-up, and the case resulted in upheaval in the Chicago Police Department, including the firing of the police superintendent. This past Friday, nearly 4 years after the shooting, Jason Van Dyke was found guilty of second-degree murder. He was also convicted of 16 counts of aggravated battery with a firearm, one for each bullet that struck Laquan McDonald. Between the murder and battery convictions, Van Dyke will likely go to prison for years. There's a lot to get to in this story, and joining us now to help break it down is Megan Crapeau. She covers the Cook County Criminal Courts for the Chicago Tribune. Jamie Calvin is also with us. Jamie's the executive director of Invisible Institute, a journalism organization based on the south side of Chicago. Megan and Jamie, thanks for joining us on the 21st.
Thanks so much for having me.
Good to be with you.
Jamie, let's start with you. This certainly has been a huge story in Chicago that's been going on for a long time, and it really hits at so many big picture issues in American life, especially when it comes to race, policing, and our criminal justice system. Before we dive into all of that, I'd like to step back and learn about the two people involved in this case, especially for our listeners who might have been hearing about this story, but who haven't followed it as closely as you have. So, Jamie, briefly, if you could, who was Laquan McDonald?
So, we know surprisingly little about Laquan McDonald. He was a teenager who was in foster care, had been in and out of sort of juvenile justice, the juvenile justice system. But you know, there's been reporting on his background, but we actually to this day know relatively little about him. And in a curious way, I don't know if Megan would agree with me about this. I think it's also true of Officer Jason Van Dyke, the officer who shot him. We know a vast amount about this case, and it, as you indicated, precipitated just cataclysmic events in Chicago that continue and will continue for years in terms of the institutions of policing and the criminal justice system. But at the center of it are these two individuals who collided on October 20th. And, you know, to this day, even after the trial, I would say that Jason Van Dyke's motivations, what was going through his head, remains something of a mystery.
Yeah.
No,
I'm sorry. Sorry to interrupt there. But yeah, Megan, let's bring you in here. And as Jamie mentioned, you know, we don't know that much about Jason Van Dyke. But what do we know about the man who's been convicted of Laquan McDonald's murder?
Well, at the time of the shooting, and as you said, that was October 2014, he had been on the force at CPD for about 13 years. He has a wife. He has two daughters. His wife and his father showed up in court for just about every day of trial. And his attorneys during the trial really tried to paint him as someone who was just out there trying to do his best, who had never fired his gun at any point when he was on the job until the night that he shot Laquan McDonald.
Jamie, back in 2015,
I would add, if I could add to what Megan said, the other thing that we know about Officer Van Dyke, but that was not brought into evidence at trial because of restrictions imposed by the judge, the presiding judge, is that he had a history of citizen complaints.
More than 20. Sorry to interrupt. Yeah.
You know, more than 20 complaints over a relatively short period. I think it's actually significantly more than that when it's fully tabulated. And something on the order of 10 of them were for excessive force coupled with verbal racial abuse. So, you know, and one of the big issues in Chicago is the failure of the supervisory institution, systems and disciplinary systems to hold officers accountable, to intervene, you know, at an early stage before patterns get out of control with an officer or a group of officers. So part of this story is that there were nothing in Jason Van Dyke's disciplinary history, you know, predicted what happened on October 20th, but there was reason to be concerned about this officer, and in a well-functioning system, there would have been interventions at an earlier point that might have saved Laquan McDonald's life and, you know, saved Jason Van Dyke from the fate he now faces.
Megan, before Friday, no Chicago police officer had been convicted of a murder in an on-duty shooting in nearly 50 years. What was different this time?
Frankly, I think the video made all the difference. I mean, the video showed everyone what actually happened that night, contradicting the official police narrative. And the buildup to the video's release, plus, you know, everyone seeing that footage over and over again, kind of strengthen the political and sort of social momentum that would bring charges in the first place. And then that same video, the dash cam footage of Laquan McDonald's death, was, I would say, some of the prosecution's absolutely strongest evidence. They played it for jurors over and over and over and hammered hard on the differences between what Van Dyke himself said on the stand and what you can actually see from the footage.
And Jamie, just to back up for just a minute here, when you first looked at this case, you know, back in 2014, 2015, what prompted you to look for this video?
Well, I'm glad you asked, because it this part of the story has kind of been eclipsed. It really, nobody would know the name Laquan McDonald were it not for a whistleblower in law enforcement who reached out about, you know, within a week or 10 days after the incident, with the information, first, that the shooting was not at all what had been reported in media. Secondly, that there was dash cam video. And he also had some imprecise but useful contact information for a civilian witness to the shooting that turned out to be immensely important, his testimony. And he was actually, Jose Torres is his name, he was the final witness put on by the prosecution. Part of this story is of a failure of major institutions to do their jobs, and of citizens, I mean, above all, the initial whistleblower who risked everything, certainly his career, to convey this information. Jose Torres and his son, who were citizens who happened upon this incident as it was unfolding, had an unobstructed view of it, were appalled and, insisted on telling their story. There were other civilian witnesses who were actually taken away from the scene by the police, held for several hours, and told, you couldn't possibly have seen what you say you saw. We have video that contradicts this, when in fact they were describing what happened. So, there have been a whole sequence, and ultimately culminating with the jury, 12 of our fellow citizens in Cook County, where ordinary citizens have really driven this process, including the young activists in the street, after the video came out.
And Megan, just from someone who was, in the courtroom during the trial, can you just really contrast the difference between Officer Van Dyke's account of what happened and what we saw on that dash cam video?
What he and his attorneys were trying to put forward was that the dash cam video that everyone has seen is not from Van Dyke's perspective. He got up there, and actually so did his partner that night, who was called as a prosecution witness, both got up there saying that Laquan McDonald was staring right at us. He turned toward us. He swung the knife around. And ultimately, jurors did not believe that version of events. They did not see that on the dash cam video, and they returned a second-degree murder conviction.
And Megan, before the verdict was announced, Chicago police were braced for it to go the other way. Can you describe the atmosphere in the city before that verdict was announced?
From what I understand, the whole city was pretty much brought to a standstill, listening and watching for this verdict as it was read. As you mentioned, police went to 12-hour days, canceled days off in case of any kind of, I guess you could call it, civil unrest or protest that might get out of hand. That never materialized. There were demonstrations that were all peaceful. And keep in mind, the demonstrations after the video was released in 2015 were also, they were disruptive, but they were peaceful. And again, we saw people take to the streets, and I think the activists largely saw this as a victory.
Jamie, as someone who broke the story that the police version of the Laquan McDonald shooting did not match what witnesses saw in the video, how does it feel to see the results in court?
Oh, it was an extraordinary moment. I mean, I think we all who were in the courtroom, and I think many people across the city had a sense of something really momentous happening. And I want to be clear that what was at issue in the trial was a very narrow issue relative to the broad issues, that will require fundamental changes in institutions that have arisen from the Laquan McDonald, incident itself. But the as narrow as the case was, this was really almost a classic murder case. Did individual X murder individual Y? Stripped of all that other context, the verdict itself had huge implication in the larger context. And if this had gone the other way, I don't know that there would have been civil, disorder to the degree that people feared. There was a sort of taint of racism to some of those expectations. But I think there would have been despair in large parts of the population, that any kind of meaningful change is possible. So there was that, but then there was also something quite stunning to me, which is, when I first published about this case in early February of 2015, I titled the article 16 Shots, you know, a phrase that has resonated throughout Chicago, chanted in the streets. And at the end of the trial, when the verdict was read by the clerk in the court, an African-American woman, you know, there's the first-degree murder charge, but then there were 16 other counts of aggravated battery with a firearm. And so basically each bullet was a crime. And Officer Van Dyke was found guilty on each of those counts. And she read those out, you know, count number one, count number two, reading out the full charge and the guilty charge. And it just, I think, you know, it was an electric moment, and it built and built in the courtroom. And the courtroom, you know, included Officer Van Dyke's family, members of Laquan McDonald's family, members of the Fraternal Order of Police, activists who have been pushing for police reform. I think in that moment, everybody was in the same space.
Megan, do we know if Officer Van Dyke plans to appeal the guilty verdicts in this case?
Yes, they have made very clear that they plan to take this to higher courts. That's not something that they can do really until after sentencing. So it'll be another few months before that process gets started. There are some procedural issues, and I imagine there will be some significant debate in court over the proper sentence for him. I mean, the aggravated battery counts carry at least 6 years. I imagine, though, his attorneys might try and get the sentencing merged, and second degree actually carries a lighter sentence than aggravated battery. That's not even mandatory prison time on second degree, so we'll see.
Jamie, just a couple of minutes left here, but do you think this verdict will result in changes in the Chicago Police Department? Of course, there are bigger systemic issues here, but what about this verdict? Will it result in real change?
I think so. I mean, there's another case coming of other officers involved in the incident who falsified reports, you know, the kind of what's referred to loosely as the code of silence case. That will have equal and greater impact on the department, you know, changing the incentive structure if officers are really afraid of you know, mutually reinforcing statements in cases like this. But yeah, I think it will have an impact. And mostly it allows the process to go forward now, the process of systemic change. And I think if this had gone sideways and ended up with an acquittal, it would have set the larger process back in really damaging ways.
And Megan, what are some of the biggest questions you have about this going forward, not just with this case and what happens with Jason Van Dyke, but what it says about Chicago?
You know, I think the reaction from the police unions after the verdict has been pretty telling. The local Fraternal Order of Police president basically said, "We're disappointed. You know, I spoke to lots of officers that, you know, supported Officer Van Dyke and don't think this should have happened." The president of the state police union, the Illinois FOP, was extremely, well, he came out and said that the jurors essentially were duped, that this was a foolish process. It never should have happened. And I think, you know, that this verdict does kind of reinforce that attitude among people who are inclined to think that Van Dyke should never have been charged at all.
Well, we'll have to wrap it up there. We're out of time for today. But Jamie Calvin, Executive Director of Invisible Institute on the south side of Chicago, and Megan Crapo, who covers Cook County Criminal Courts for the Chicago Tribune. Thanks so much, both of you, for joining us today on the 21st.
Thank you.
Good to be with you.
And there's all sorts of great reporting about this issue. We'll tweet that all out, a lot of it out through the 21st account. So stay with us for more coming up on the 21st.
The 21st is made possible in part by Krannert Art Museum at the University of Illinois. presenting Coveting Nature, Art, Collecting, and Natural History in Early Modern Europe, an exhibition of botanical artwork from U of I Collections. More information is available at kam.illinois.edu.
Tuning into the 21st, I'm Nyla Boodoo. While temperatures are dropping and daylight is shrinking, we've got to embrace the good things about fall, which include one of the best colorful leaves. We wanted to help you get out there and enjoy all of the beautiful foliage that Illinois has to offer. Whether you're coming from Chicago or Champaign or Rockford or anywhere in between, you can hit the road and take in oranges, reds, and yellows, and maybe make a fun pit stop while we're at it. Our guide on this fall leaves trek is Nuno Ribeiro. He's an assistant professor at the University of Illinois Department of Recreation, Sport, and Tourism, and in our Urbana studios. Nuno, welcome back to the 21st.
Hi, Nyla. It's an absolute pleasure.
Yeah, this is so exciting to talk about fall leaves. We love this. It's like the most beautiful time of year for all of this.
It certainly is.
For all of our listeners, you're welcome to join us with your favorite spots. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet as well to 21stshow your pictures or your ideas. And I know you have picked out some great drives from
us. I do.
So you've had tons, right? You picked out two drives from
Chicago.
It
was very difficult. It was, Nyla, it was incredibly difficult because it's such a beautiful state with so many locales, both known and not so well known, in which to enjoy the beautiful fall scenery that we are lucky to enjoy in the state, that I had a very difficult time. So I want to apologize in advance. I mean, if I don't mention your favorite spot, please call our show and tell us about it. With that in mind, you know, Illinois is the type of state that has a lot of this, we like to call the hidden gems, right, Nyla? And I know that in the show you've talked about a lot of them. So it's, I tried to pick a couple spots that while they may be known to a lot of people, they may be not known to everyone. So perhaps we could start our trip, say, from Chicago.
Well, actually, I was thinking we should start from where you are.
Okay.
Near Urbana. So let's start the opposite
direction.
Okay, so
if we head south,
right,
if we drive about 170 miles, we can visit Alton, which is right near St. Louis, and it has one of the most beautiful pieces of drivable scenery within the United States with absolutely zero exaggeration. The Great Rivers Road is one of the most beautiful and scenic drives you can take in North America. Dare I say, in the entire American continent. It is a scant 170 miles away. It is a beautiful, it's about 50 miles along the river, Nyla. It is gorgeous.
Give us directions here. Where would you go?
We would head straight south towards St. Louis and then detour to Alton. And I would make a delicious detour while in Alton and go to a place called Mygis Desserts. And I just can't help myself and just have one piece of pie.
Okay.
I usually go for two or three.
So would that be, so then would you be taking 55 there?
Uh-huh.
Would you be
uh-huh.
taking, so that would be 55. Okay.
Yep.
55 south from Champaign.
And it's about, you know, if you take a pit stop, you know, just 3 hours or so. It's a nice day trip, although a little tiring, so I might recommend staying overnight. Plenty of beautiful places to stay, you know, go out for a nice dinner. Because on the way back, I would say, you know, stop at Pere Marquette State Park.
Yes, tell us about Pere Marquette
State Park. So Pere Marquette State Park has perhaps, they have about 12 miles of beautiful trails, and it has these beautiful tiny little hidden waterfalls, these beautiful boulders. If you are photography fans, it's one of the most beautiful places to take those amazing fall photos, either by yourself, with your friends, with your family, significant other, those beautiful kid photos. It's just absolutely gorgeous.
So you can do all of your holiday photos now.
Oh, my goodness. Absolutely. And again, go eat pie. Eat
right.
more pie. I think most people need to eat more pie.
Well, especially this time of year. This is the perfect time of year,
yes.
Right?
Yes, it most certainly is.
So that's if you're going to go south. That's
what if
Alton.
You go west?
Right.
From Champaign, it's a little bit closer. It's about 140 miles. towards Galesburg.
Okay, and so that's going to go through. So then are you going to go, so you're going to go Galesburg, but are you going to go
through Bloomington and Peoria?
Okay.
Yes, and there is plenty to eat and drink and see in both Bloomington and Peoria. So apologizes in advance if I don't mention all of your favorite spots. I just want to highlight
all of our listeners who are in Bloomington.
Yes,
and
they're
Peoria.
All marvelous. Yeah. Trust me, please, we want to hear about them. In Bloomington, I want to highlight the old courthouse in Bloomington, which is now where the State History Museum is. And it is an absolutely beautiful building. It's at a great museum, loads of great places to eat, depending on what you like, right around the courthouse. It's an absolutely beautiful place. And also, on your way near Bloomington, a scant about 17 miles on I-55, in the little village of McLean, Illinois, population 830, more or less, there is a place, Nyla, where the 1980s and the 1990s have survived. Arcadia, America's playable arcade museum and pinball paradise. Now, if you remember Dance Dance Revolution and Mortal Kombat and all those arcade games that ate a substantial portion...
I must say I'm not a huge aficionado of arcade games, but I think you are, it sounds
like. I am.
Like.
They yeah. consumed a substantial portion of my allowance when I was a kid. And there's the element of nostalgia, not just arcade games, but pinball. I'm a huge fan. And there's an arcade playable museum and pinball paradise that you have to see it to believe it.
In case you're tired of looking at leaves for a bit,
absolutely.
You can take a little break from that. Okay.
Not to mention there's a vintage Wurlitzer with all the 80s and 90s catalog, all the Depeche Modes that you can possibly think, they're all there.
Okay.
So as we move on, we might do a little pit stop in Bloomington, and I might eat beautiful Thai food in the little kind of sort of tucked away in. It's called the Thai House of Bloomington. And I think it's probably one of the best Thai meals that I've eaten in the state, Chicago included. So it's tucked away on the way towards Bloomington. It's just about a 5-minute drive off the interstate. I might top off that meal with a delicious coffee by an award-winning coffee shop and roaster called Coffee Hound Roasters. If you're really nice, and I'm sure all our listeners are, if you ask for a tour of their roasting facilities, please do so. They are more than willing to oblige. The coffee is delicious, and it's very, very educational.
Well, Nuno, you're talking all about, there's a lot of food, so I feel like people are going to need to work off all of this
absolutely.
Food by going probably through some parks. So you had mentioned Père Marquette State
yes,
Park as a place.
That is a great segue
great
because
yeah.
you can burn off all those calories along one of the most beautiful trails that we have in the state, which is right off Bloomington. It's the Constitutional Trail.
And where does that run? Where does that run along?
It runs right through Bloomington and it heads west, northwest. It's just absolutely magnificent. And you can walk, hike, take photos, jog, run, bike. It's an absolutely beautiful trail.
Okay, so we've done south and central Illinois. Let's go a little further north. What about
right.
Kankakee?
All right.
In the Kankakee area.
If by any chance, if we are heading south from Chicago, about 60 miles south from Chicago, we head towards, and Nyla, this is one of my favorite hidden gems of Illinois and my favorite parks. It's Kankakee River State Park. And I think for my money, it's probably one of the most beautiful hikes I have taken in the state. It's just magnificent. It's all along the river. There's about 11.5 miles of beautiful manicured landscape trails. You know, the state workers at DNR and the state parks, they do an absolutely marvelous job. And it's just so scenic and so remarkable. It's very difficult to disconnect from your phone because you'll want to post this on Instagram like I always do.
No. So Kankakee River State Park, is that off of 57 then?
It is on 57 South.
Okay.
Just a little ways off. It's a little bit before you get to Kankakee proper. So
okay.
If you're heading south from Chicago, it's a little bit to the west of you.
Right. Okay. So Kankakee River State Park, lots of hikes there. And that's another great one. So let's go. How about if we went a little further north?
Right. I think one of the most famous places as far as foliage and as far as watching the scenery in the fall is probably Galena. And Galena is about 160 miles north. It's actually part of an
Chicago.
Yes. It's part of, this is really interesting, Nyla. It's part of an old stagecoach trail that used to run Chicago Galena. On the way to Galena, stop at Rockford and see, we have one of these little ex libris of the state, the Anderson Japanese Gardens. And they're some of the most beautiful in the United States. And the foliage along the beautiful landscape Japanese gardens is just absolutely magnificent. You know, the little waterfalls, the lily ponds, the meditation gardens. There's a beautiful tea house tucked away in a corner. That's an absolute marvel.
And there's some interesting history around there, right? Is that also where Ulysses S. Grant
lived
before
right.
the Civil War?
Absolutely. And you have Ulysses S. Grant's house, which you can visit, along also with in Kankakee, you have also the Bradley House. I forgot to mention that earlier.
Oh, right. That's one of the Frank Lloyd Wright houses.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. There's a little gem of a house by Frank Lloyd Wright called Bradley House in Kankakee. But yes, you're absolutely right. Those are Ulysses S. Grant's stomping grounds. There's a variety of tours that you can take. And I think one of the easiest things that you could do for our listeners who are not familiar with the area is to contact the local historical societies. They often have a variety of tours. They act as excellent local guides to the area.
We've got lots of lists here. Nuno and I'm with Nuno Ribeiro. He's at University of Illinois. And I feel like the University of Illinois' most excited ambassador of tourism for Illinois who's with us.
I certainly hope so.
So there's a lot of details. We're going to tweet all of these out. So we've gone through quite a few. We still have a couple more to go through. But if you follow us, our handle is 21ST Show. It looks like there's some folks who love on Twitter. Rose on Twitter says she's a big fan of the Thai House. So there you go. You've got one.
Great.
You've got one person also who's agreeing with you there on your plans, Nuno. Another thing about Galena, actually, you had some food you wanted
sure.
to recommend as well.
This is, I think, one of my favorite places to eat German and French food. There's a little bistro called Fritz and Frit. I heartily recommend the schnitzel and the poulet rôti. It's a tiny little French bistro, very quaint, very interesting, that serves excellent food. And it's a little bit outside of the ordinary. So I think our listeners would definitely enjoy stopping by. I would also have them check out the Belvedere Mansion, which is a little gem of an architectural turn of the century, mid-1800s, early 1900s, just absolutely magnificent. Go and visit.
So we have done almost all of the state, but we would be very remiss if we neglected the southern part of the state.
Yes,
and we haven't
we
talked about
would.
Shawnee National Forest, which
yes.
I imagine must be so beautiful this time of
year.
Oh,
my goodness, Nyla. It is magnificent. The only reason why I hesitate to mention it in the beginning is just it's a little bit further drive, but believe me, to the people who are listening to us, it is absolutely worth it.
And so you recommend Dixon Springs State Park?
Right.
No, no?
So it's part of the actual Shawnee National Forest, which is about 200 miles south of Champaign. And Dixon Springs State Park is within the Shawnee National Forest. All the Shawnee National Forest is amazing, but this is a personal favorite of mine, Nyla. And Dixon Springs State Park has, I think, I have this embedded in my memory. You know, there's a tiny little waterfall. There's a little pathway that opens up. It's almost like a natural mansion that welcomes you. It's just absolutely gorgeous.
And we would remiss if we didn't mention, there's kind of, I think, the one obvious state park we haven't mentioned, which is Starved Rock.
Yes.
Right? And I think Starved Rock is sort of one of the state parks people always think of in uh-huh. Illinois. And imagine this time of year, Starved Rock and Matheson State Park really
right.
popular locations.
They
too.
Are very popular. And I'm so glad you mentioned Matheson State Park, because they're kitty corner to one another. They're very, very close. So if you have made plans to visit Starved Rock State Park, which, by the way, I applaud, I think it's wonderful, do be careful. This time of the year, it starts getting a little bit slippery. Do use appropriate attire and shoes. But Matheson State Park is a scan. It's maybe a 15-minute drive, and they are very, very easily doable within the same day trip. And both Starved Rock and Matheson State Park, they're about 100 miles west of Chicago. So it's very, very doable.
Okay, great. No. So it sounds like we've got some great locations for everybody to do fall drives for. So thank you so much.
You are most welcome.
For joining us for that. Nuno Ribeiro is an assistant professor with the Department of Recreation, Sport, and Tourism at the University of Illinois. We're going to post all of these lists online at 21stshow.org. And you can always see, we're going to tweet it out as well at 21SGShow. Nuno, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Nyla, you're most welcome. It was a pleasure.
That's all the time we have for today. If you follow us on Twitter, our handle is 21STShow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. You can also search for our Facebook page to like us. All those links, every other way to contact us. If you'd like to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or follow us at social media, just go to our website, 21stshow.org. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. Vishesh Anand is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. See you back here tomorrow.